Hello and welcome to Golden Grenades, an infrequent podcast these days about birds with stories from those of us who recognise them as our avian superiors, all set against the heartwarming and uplifting backdrop of an environmental apocalypse. This episode, my special guest is Graham Appleton. Graham started birdwatching and ringing when at school in Birmingham and became heavily involved in the Wash Wader research group as a teenager. After a first career as a maths teacher and deputy headmaster, Graham worked for the BTO from 1997 to 2013, initially as a fundraiser and latterly as director of communications. He has been a Wader fanatic for 50 years and writes the popular blog Wader Tales, in which he describes the latest findings from Wader researchers in ways that the rest of us can understand. Graham, hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and for redressing the balance, which is the fact that waders have been criminally underrepresented, I would think, on this podcast so far. I've done 30 episodes, 5 birds a pop, and we've only had a handful of waders mentioned. So I'm hoping that you're the man to set that balance right. So one thing I was wondering about is, you know, winter time tends to be a bit of a glum time for a lot of us. I look forward to seeing waxwings, which obviously sets me up for a fall most winters, but it's been brilliant this year. A lot of people get a kick out of geese, but you know, for you, I'm guessing that winter is probably a reasonably busy time of year.
It's a great time, and it's the only time when this country is at all important to birds. unless you count seabirds around the edges, most of the rest of Britain is particularly useless for birds. We get some summer migrants arriving, I believe. But in the wintertime, we're full of geese and ducks and waders and gulls, and the place is stuffed. This is the time, because of the Gulf Stream, when the UK is really important.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the weather puts you off, doesn't it, going out on a cold winter's day, especially to the coast where you have to go to find the territory that's necessary for good birdwatching at this time of year. And it can be a real drag to get out, I think. But I do love a purple sandpiper, so that usually gets me out. So what have you been up to this winter?
So we do the general stuff. My wife, Jenny Gill, and I do a bird trap walk most days, but that's just around our patch. And there we love the arrival of winter birds. We love the first field fares and the first redwings. It's great when a flock of pink-footed geese go over. If a curlew flies through, it makes our day. So central Norfolk's not great for birds, but yeah, we probably enjoy our winter birding more than we enjoy our summer birding.
Yeah, that's good. I think obviously as a wader aficionado, you've been writing wader tales for many years now. When did that first start?
So it's 8 years. Coming up 8 years, yes.
And if any listeners have not explored Wader Tales, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's even for the novice, it's an excellent resource, and there's so much on there that you can learn. Very focused on the science, but as I mentioned in the introduction, presented in a way that is very readable and understandable. I think when it comes to waders, you know, there's various populations and some come from one place and some come from another, and the ones we get at certain times of year might be any of the various different populations.
Yeah, there's a Wader Tales called Which Wader, When and Why, which basically says which ones come in at what season. And there's migration of waders happening at any time of the year in this country. So we are currently at the start of March, and there are already oyster catchers have left to go to Iceland. The Bartol godwits are flying over our heads at night, going from the west coast to the east coast and then further east. We've got lapwings returning to breeding sites. It's any time of the year that a wader's on the move, and I just get fascinated.
I think when you start, or certainly when I started birdwatching as a kid, you know, you just learn what they look like. And, you know, when you get a little bit more involved, you might learn where they might be. But I think once you learn and start to read more about their habits and their movements, I think that's when it really gets interesting. And it's one of the real sort of draw points, I think, of waders, because they do move around so much. And that is interesting in itself.
Yeah, and I'm privileged to be a bird ringer. So I learnt most of my waders in the hand. And you can learn so much about these birds just by seeing which feathers are molting at what stage, and then realizing that if you make a catch of Dunlin in May, you could be having seeing birds that are going east to Russia or northwest to Iceland or even on to Greenland. And then it's that this fascination of trying to understand the individual bird and then fit it into the whole pattern.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's funny you should mention Dunlin there, because the BTO book that I helped them with, Into the Red, you wrote about the Dunlin, and Dunlin is one of 11 waders on the current red list. And it's one that maybe would surprise people a bit, I think. It's a relatively common bird, but it's about the fact that it has declined a lot.
Yeah, so the red list, there are three criteria that, well, there are many criteria, but the three key ones are how many are there, how many of those are in the UK, so how many are we responsible for, and what's been happening to them. And for the Dunlin, we are responsible for a lot of Europe's Dunlin, and the numbers are going down, which is why they've ended up on the red list. And in fact, we've mentioned several red-listed waders already. Lapwing, curlew, to name but two, at Purple Sandpiper, added to the list at the same time as Dunlin. Mm. It is really quite a long list. There are species on that aren't on there that you might expect to be, like red shank, which is just sort of very, very close to being on the list. And the species you might think would be on the list because they're rare or have been rare, like Avocet, which aren't on the list. So it's an interesting list, and that's one of the things about the blog that I wrote about the book, which basically explains why each of the species gets is honoured by being on the book. And please, you do yourself a disservice. You did far more than help the BTO with the book. You inspired the first one, and we have a lot to be grateful to you for.
Oh, thank you. It was a joy to work on and bring those people together. But yeah, they do seem to be quite heavily represented. 70 birds on the current list, 11 waders. You know, there's obviously a fair number of seabirds and farmland birds, but they do seem to be quite heavily represented there. And it's a variety of reasons, as you alluded to there, as to why they're on the list.
So some of them are on there for breeding reasons. Yep. So for instance, the curlew is on there because its breeding numbers are in such decline. The lapwing is on there because it's a breeding species. The black-tailed godwit's on there because the Limosa subspecies is in such small numbers. But a lot of them are winter birds. And again, it comes back to what I was saying a little earlier, that in the winter, this country is important, and therefore we have more responsibility for waders than we probably do for other species.
Right, we'll crack on. You've chosen five bird species to talk about today. This podcast is based on the not unlikely scenario of an environmental collapse in the near future, and I ask each guest to choose five birds, their five favourite species that they would save above all others to go onto the metaphorical ark to save them from certain extinction. Now, we had a little chat beforehand, and I know if you were to choose five birds to save from extinction, the list might be very different, but this is five birds that mean a lot to you. So let's start with
bird number one.
You've mentioned godwits, and you've chosen a godwit as bird number one. But which one?
Well, that was tricky. I wanted to include a whole family. So when I first got into godwits, it was the bar-tailed godwit was my favourite. And if you look at my university notes, you'll see that there are doodles of bar-tailed godwits littered throughout my maths lecture notes. And then the Hudsonian godwit was a special species because I spent 3 summers in James Bay, which is the bottom part of Hudson Bay in Canada, studying waders. And the Hudsonian godwit is just such an amazing bird in that they take off from James Bay and basically finish up in South America and do nothing in between times. They just fly and fly and fly. And that was very impressive. But I've actually gone for the black-tailed godwit because otherwise my marriage would be under threat. Jenny Gill and I spent an awful lot of our time studying black-tailed godwits, and I've got to love them almost as much as I like her, really. They're a really great bird, and that's why I chose the black-tailed godwit. We follow them, so we will go to Portugal to see them in Portugal, see the same bird in the UK as they pause on their overtake manoeuvre to get to Iceland, and then see the same bird again when we get to Iceland. And One of the things we do in Iceland in April is take part in a sort of a bird watch for the general public. And it's great being on a small estuary just outside Reykjavik, looking at the black-tailed gulgrets and saying, that is a bird that I last saw in Portugal. And it blows people away. So black-tailed gulgrets, just because I know so many of them as individuals and spend so much time looking at them.
Amazing. And I'm guessing when you're talking about recognizing birds as individuals, that's the rings.
There are a few individuals you recognize without the rings, just because they're so big and so pale and always in the same place, or so, et cetera. But yeah, so we'll talk about color rings, the old-fashioned, cheap plastic way of doing, inverted commas, tracking of waders. And we can track the waders because so many people love looking at black-tailed godwits and report the colorings. So we have got 20-year histories of the same birds visiting the same places year after year after year because people report them.
Amazing, isn't it? And I mean, 20 years. What's the longest lived godwit that you know of?
So for a black-tailed godwit, we know that they can live for 25 years, and the plastic rings are going to take that a lot further, because we started colouring them in 1997. That might be the wrong year, at that sort of time. And that means that there are a lot of birds now which are 25 years old. And so for the longevity record for them will increase just because there are more of them ringed. For bar-tailed godwit, I think it's over 30 years. There's a Wadertails blog about long-lived waders, and the numbers are in there, but bar-tailed is over 30.
I think I read when I previously on the podcast discussed an oyster catcher that the longest lived currently recorded wader is an oyster catcher that was 35 years old.
Oh, no, that's nothing.
No?
That's no. 41 years is now the record.
Oh.
And I think, if I remember rightly, there might be a European one at 46, but certainly on the BTO scheme, the record is 41 years for an oyster catcher.
Wow.
And that was a bird that was ringed on the Wash and shot in France 41 years later.
Oh,
Quite, yes.
that's
What a sad end to a venerable bird, yes.
terrible. Obviously, a lot of waders over the years have been subject to patchy history in terms of being killed for the table and trophy hunters and the Victorian times and egg collectors. And I guess the black-tailed godwit was no stranger to that. And there was a 100-year breeding absence, I believe, until the 1950s.
That's right. So we've got two. We need to think about two subspecies of black-tailed godwit. We've got Limosa, which is the one that breeds here, where we're very much on the edge of the range, and for many years there were non-breeding in this country, and they now breed largely in the fens, in the Nene Washes, and in the Ouse Washes. That's the tiny population, and then there are the big flocks of Icelandic birds. And they are not surprisingly called Icelandica, and those are the ones we see in flocks of 1,000 or more in the wintertime. Icelandica are doing very well. They've enjoyed the warmer weather of Iceland over the last X years with climate warming. They've benefited hugely from that. They've enjoyed the intensification of agriculture because up to this point, what's happened is that it's increased nutrient levels, and that's meant bigger food items for them to eat. And because of the warming, the nesting season has got longer. So black-tailed godwits have done very well in Iceland, as opposed to the ones, the Limosa subspecies, which is doing really, really badly, especially in its main country, which is the Netherlands. So it's the Dutch national bird, and they've been a huge amount of work goes into trying to keep numbers up, but they're having a really tough time. So very big difference between Limosa that we see in the summer and Icelandica that we see in the winter.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And can you talk a little bit about the head starting project?
Yes, so to try to increase the number of black-tailed godwits, the head starting, which was taking eggs, the first eggs that appear from clutches of godwits, leaving them to lay another clutch, so still having a chance of a good successful breeding season, taking four eggs from each pair and putting them into an incubator and then raising them from that stage until the youngsters are ready to be released. And that head starting process, which was carried out by WWT and RSPB, has been very successful in that the youngsters that were released into populations that still existed, but boosted them hugely, meaning that birds that have been hand-reared are now raising their own chicks. Now, it's not a long-term solution. It's a very expensive solution. But when conservation organizations were looking for ways to improve conditions for godwits, it was a way of giving an extra boost at a time where we didn't quite know what would be necessary to turn the numbers around again. So head starting is always a temporary solution, but if you're running out of time to save a species, it actually works well, as we've seen in swoon-billed sandpipers flying from Russia to Asia. Their head starting has probably saved the species from extinction. I think it might be extinct by now, functionally, if head starting hadn't given them a boost.
Amazing stuff, and it is incredible to think that these birds that have been head started are still coming back to the exact same sites.
Yes, and that is because that's what they know. It's not that you're programmed to go from spot A to spot B. I think that's important, that the programming is to migrate, and then you migrate with your with birds of the same species. So you learn from those around you. It's not that everything is programmed in detail from the time you hatch.
And is it right? I think I read this on Wader Tales. Is it right that pairs of birds synchronize in terms of when they come back to their breeding sites, you know, so they land within hours of each other, the male and female that are largely monogamous?
Yes, work that was done in Iceland by Thomas Gunnarsson, Jenny Gill, and others has shown that the adults get back onto territory within 1 or 2 days of each other. And if there's more than a 2 day gap, then it's quite likely there'll be a divorce because you've wintered in completely different areas. At the time of that paper, no pair of godwits was the male and female wintering in the same country, let alone on the same estuary. So you've got to go back to the same place because it makes a big difference if you know your partner when it comes to raising youngsters, knowing the synchrony, knowing the patch. So you go back to the same patch. And if one of the partners isn't there, then you don't know whether that's death or lateness. So you only give it a couple of days, breeding season's short, and then you will then try and find somebody else. And in fact, there are cases where a bird has been partnered with their traditional mate. In 1 year, he was late coming back. She moved in with the guy next door. But when he came back on time, in the subsequent year, she went back to the old guy. So, and if you think about it, if you're a pair of waders, you've got to know your patch, but you've got to know your partner. The business of nesting is really, it has to be a partnership. If you're working as a pair, that changeover between the male brooding and the female brooding has got to be done right. So you've got to get that right. You've got to know what's her pattern? When's she going to want to leave? When have I got to be there? Knowing that sort of thing is really important. And the other thing is, if one of them's on the nest, then the other one's keeping guard. And therefore, you've got to, knowing your partner, having trust in your partner is really important during the breeding season. And that, for a long-lived bird, seems to have real dividends.
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? If the long-term partner is a bit tardy and then they go with the next door neighbor, there's that gamble that he might be taking his eye off the job when he's keeping toot.
Absolutely. So it really is important. There's some really interesting stuff on the patterns of changeovers of individual pairs of birds, because it is very different between even pairs which nest quite close together. So there are general patterns for species, but within species, different pairs behave differently.
Amazing stuff. And there's so much about black-tailed godwits and all waders, but particularly the black-tailed godwit, I would say, on Wader Tales. So you can read about all of this to your heart's content, but it's all fascinating stuff. Brilliant. Let's move on to your second choice.
Bird number two.
So bird number two is a sanderling, and I've been setting you up for this in some ways. So sanderling is a species that's actually doing really well in this country. It's nowhere near any red or amber list. Numbers in the wintertime are going up, which is possibly linked to our warmer winters. And it's there for two reasons. The first is I just love them. When you see sanderling running up and down a beach, I don't know, it lightens the heart. And then you look at them and you see that they've only got three toes instead of the four of most waders, and you realize why they have to keep running, because they actually, it's not that easy standing still if you've got three toes instead of four. So they're always on the move, and they're just a delightful bird. So that's the first reason. But the second reason is that there are a few papers that I've written blogs about which have really blown my mind. And one of them is a blog about sandling called Travel Advice for Sandling. And Jeroen Reneerkens has done excellent research into the Greenlandic sandling. And he has shown that birds from the same brood can winter, chicks from the same brood, can winter as far apart as Scotland and Southern Africa. It blows apart the myth that migration is fully programmed, because you've got two chicks, same parents, one in Scotland and one in South Africa, or Southern Africa, Namibia more likely than Southern Africa. And it brings in this idea of happenstance. So what you do in that first autumn when you come south from Greenland, some of you end up in Scotland, some in Portugal, some in West Africa, and some in Southern Africa. But what you do in that first winter affects the chances of survival, how long it takes for you to get back to Greenland to nest, because some nest in the second year, but most nest in the first, how early you can get back to Greenland, because getting back early is good if you want to nest successfully, and how well you survive. So a bird that winters in Britain is actually doing really well. Not only has it travelled less far, which means less flying, but it also has a very high survival rate. Now, the chances are that if we'd go back 20 years, they wouldn't have had those same survival rates because we had proper winters. But these days, the survival rate of an English bird is as good as one from Namibia. The sad thing is, the birds that winter close to the equator have really poor survival rate. So if you happen to go to Mauritania for the winter, it's really not good. You have a lower chance of survival. You can't feed up fast enough, so you get away from there later in the season. So therefore, you get back to Greenland later. And you are less likely to be able to fit enough to go back in your first summer returning. So everything is wrong if you winter in Mauritania. But because you're alive and because you know nothing else, you do it the next year. Because waders don't change what they do. But there are a few differences. Lapwings, for instance, which in a cold winter will travel further. But for most waders, they will do exactly the same the year after next. So that happenstance, that where you happen to end up in the first winter, who you travel with, how far you get, what the weather does, which flocks you end up with, is really important in that first winter.
What a bummer if you get in with the wrong crowd.
Absolutely. And there, that might not have been the wrong crowd 30 years ago. But these days, that could be the wrong crowd. And we see it with black-tailed godwits as well, coming from Iceland. We're seeing more and more of them wintering in the northern part of Britain, which used to be a bad thing to do, but now it's a good thing. So the flocks in Scotland will not contain birds that are more than 10 years old, for instance, well, more than 15 years old, because the very old birds will be the ones that are in Hampshire, because that's been the traditional site for birds to go to.
I guess if originally birds have always gone to the one place, does it just take some sandling innovator to say, right, I'm going to go somewhere else this year? Or, how does that new route develop? It's not just like Jet2 decided to put on a new flight. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's really, really good. So it's the pioneers who make things happen. So we know that vagrant birds turn up in different places. And we see it with green sandpipers, for instance. We're seeing more and more green sandpipers wintering further north. Now, in a bad winter, most of the ones that winter in Scotland will be knocked out. And it'll take generations of youngsters to fill those spaces. Now, if the cold winters are far enough apart, you'll get a wintering population. But if the cold winters are only every couple of years, then the trend won't happen. The other thing that they do is that birds travel with adults. And what we know about the black-tailed godwits that leave Iceland early in the summer, at the end of July, so the youngsters, which are on really, really early broods, they're leaving at the same time as experienced adults. Whereas the ones that leave later in the season from late broods or colder areas, they travel south later And they're the ones that are more likely to end up in northern areas where older generations are not present. So
Ah.
seems to be happening is, for species where you've got a decent number of youngsters being produced, then you have the pioneers to find new places. For species where you don't have youngsters being produced, you don't have those pioneers to find the new places. So you just get stuck into a horrible rut.
It's fascinating stuff, isn't it? It's funny you should mention the fact that they run in and out of the waves, sandlings. I was just watching them 2 or 3 weeks ago up by me on the coast there, and just really enjoying that movement that they do and how they stay millimeters away from the wave edge at all times, constantly on the move. And you can almost put the Benny Hill theme tune into their little legs running, couldn't you? You know, over the top. They're just really comedic birds. It just reminded me, as I was watching them, of the fact that, you know, as a kid, you do that. You dash in and out of the waves, not trying not to get caught. And they just look like they're playing a game, which of course they're not. They're picking up tiny crustaceans and doing important stuff rather than just messing around.
Yeah, one of the other thing you might notice is that sandling don't like wind. So on a windy day, they will try and find shelter. So next time you have a windy day, look for sandling hiding behind clumps of seaweed. Because again, it's the lack of that hind toe. They're not as stable as other waders. So they need to spend more of their time sheltering than do other waders.
Again, really interesting. And they're beautiful little birds, you know, they're so white underneath. They are spectacular to look at. And one thing I've always wondered, and maybe you're the man to ask, if a baby puffin is called a puffling, does that mean a baby sandling is a sandalingling?
I'm willing to go with it if you say so. Oh, sounds
Yeah.
okay to me. Yeah, that'll do. Yeah, okay. We'll go for a
All
sanderlingling.
right.
They're lovely. And they're wonderful in both the plumages. That winter plumage is just so striking, and the summer plumage is just so gorgeous. Did you know that when they change from winter plumage to summer plumage, they smell different too?
I didn't know that. I would love to sniff one, though.
Yeah, I don't know whether we could discern it, but the scent that they produce changes. So a lot of waders have different smells in the winter to the summer, when they move from monoesters to diesters. So the preen gland isn't there to smell; it's there to look after the feathers. But the one that they have in the summertime is actually less smelly, and that is probably quite an advantage if you're a bird that nests on the ground.
Well, very interesting. It's a bit like putting, I guess, different creosote on your fence at different times of year.
Yes, or the wax you put on your boots for winter walking.
Exactly. Yeah. But they breed up in the Arctic, don't they? And then they just winter everywhere else. They go
Yes.
everywhere, pretty much.
Yep, they're one of the waders you can find almost anywhere, almost like a grey plover. Any coast you're on, you can find a sandling.
Excellent. So let's move on. Let's talk about your third choice.
Bird number three.
Oyster catcher is. It's a favorite bird by default. I used to be a canonet license holder, and I used to turn up on a field where the recce had produced a flock of Bartel Godwits, and I'd catch oyster catchers. On a field where the recce had shown there were curlew, and I'd catch oyster catchers. Now, oyster catchers are the smelliest, most disgusting waders. They're more like gulls than they are like waders. So I had a reputation for being the person who always caught oyster catchers. And those were in the days when we didn't really want to catch oyster catchers. It's when they were really common and we weren't particularly worried about them. We're a little bit more worried about them these days. But yeah, so that's the oyster catcher chose me rather than I chose the oyster catchers. They're also fascinating birds, as we're discovering in Iceland, because we started the work in Iceland that Jen runs with her Icelandic and Portuguese colleagues. We started with black-tailed godwits and then whimbrel. But oyster catcher is now very much part of the pattern. So we've been studying the oyster catchers that move between Iceland and Britain and the rest of Europe in the same way as we have black-tailed godwits. But the focus is more on who migrates and why. In black-tailed godwits, everybody leaves Iceland. But in oyster catchers, 30% of them stay behind. So one of the things we've been looking at is, well, why do some birds migrate and other birds don't? Now, part of it is happenstance because you go with the flock. But if your father is a migrant oyster catcher, then you migrate. If your mother is a migrant oyster catcher, it doesn't really matter. You ignore what your mother does and you always do what your father does. And it's not genetics. What happens is because, as in most waders, the oyster catcher male looks after the kids for longer than the female does. Breeding is hard work, and most females get out as soon as they can. So often when the chicks are quite young, because the theory is that they need longer to be ready for the next breeding season. So they leave the males with the chicks. And if a male oyster catcher is a bird that's going to migrate, it's on a faster schedule to do things than one who's going to stay in Iceland. So if your dad is one of these sort of, well, it doesn't matter, I'm staying here for the winter anyway, and not everything happening slowly, then the chances are you hang around with him and you'll end up on the same sort of estuary as him. And in fact, you might even demand food through to October. If you're an oyster catcher where your dad is a migrant, then he's going to leave you. Your mum left a couple of weeks ago, and your dad's going to leave shortly after. And then you're going to get left in flocks of birds, and those flocks of birds are not anywhere near an estuary, and they're likely to be flocks of migrants. So you end up as a migrant. So it's the dad effect. If your dad's a migrant, you become a migrant.
Blimey.
And it's really, who expect that? It's really crazy
That
stuff.
is interesting that the mother doesn't have that same influence, but yeah, incredible. Just imagine now a little oyster catcher flying after his dad, just like, Dad, 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 take me with you.
The migrants can't do that because actually the youngsters aren't ready to leave
No.
until several weeks after the father. So they might well be flying with other oyster catchers, but they won't be their parents
Because they've already gone.
because they've already gone. So mother leaves first, father later, and then a few weeks later, when they've had a chance to fatten up, the youngsters leave, and that's the standard pattern for waders.
Oyster catcher is one of the few waders that we have discussed on the podcast before, and I mentioned the fact that it's got a lot of vernacular names. It was a sea pie, wasn't it, based on sort of beach magpie until 1731, I think I wrote down. But oike, skeldro, shalder, scotty, and my favorite, kleeper. I think it's my favorite because it almost sounds like the noise they make. You know, they make this kind of sort of really noisy, monotonous sort of almost like a bleep, a loud car alarm type noise, don't
They're not quiet. They're certainly not
they?
quiet. And a lot of these words tie in with languages from other countries which have got oyster catchers. So in Iceland, if I remember rightly, my Icelandic is appalling, but I think it's tjöldur, which is quite close to shelter. So the oyster catcher, yeah, they're really good birds. And you said they were beach birds. And yes, they were beach birds, but of course they are now farmland birds as well, up in the uplands, and rooftop nesting birds as well. So here we see pioneers doing different things in terms of nesting behaviour.
That's right. I think I read recently 28, 30% of birds have now moved inland and they're, you know, nesting in anything from quarries to, like you say, fields and yeah, flat roofed buildings and things. And the kids when they were at middle school had them on the roof there.
And it's a good strategy. If fox is one of your main predators, then being on a roof is a good thing. And like most farmland nesting waders, the ones that are nesting on farmland aren't doing very well at all. So numbers in Scotland are going down. In England, they're going up because of we're seeing them moving into new areas. But the English numbers are relatively small compared to the Scottish population, and the Scottish population has dropped quite a lot, especially in farmland.
Yeah, hopefully it's not headed for the red list like those other 11 birds.
If I recall correctly, I think it's already amber. I think it'll be a while before it's red. But
Yeah.
all is not well in the land of oyster catchers.
It's interesting as well, isn't it, that the dietary habits have had to change based on their location. So they move inland and they're eating different things to when they were picking a cockle every 72 seconds on a estuary.
So they'll be eating worms in farmland, but then going to the coast and eating cockles and mussels. So yeah, and there you've got this interesting feature of the different bill types depending on the type of food they're feeding on. So some birds will feed on worms on estuaries, and then other birds will feed on mussels in particular, and those have got a blunter, tougher tip to the bill for hammering open shellfish. And we have spent some time doing work for others on the Wash, where we've actually been measuring the tips of bills to see whether they're a prober or a basher.
Funny you should mention bills. There's a feature we have on this podcast where I ask, hopefully, a question that you've never been asked before. And I know you're a man who, over the years, done many interviews, and I'm hoping that this is one that's never been put to you before.
Zero punches pulled.
And it's about waders' bill length. So many waders have bills of a certain length to help them probe to just the right depth to get their preferred food. Bearing this in mind, which of the following, if you had to choose one of these three, would you prefer? A, your current nose, but a diet restricted to rather bland food forever. B, a larger than normal nose, and be able to eat a third more food items, but not your favorites. Or C, the largest nose you've ever seen, but you can eat absolutely everything you want.
You're right, I haven't been asked that before.
Yes.
I don't particularly like the nose I've got. I think I would prefer to be able to eat a variety of things, so I think I would have to have as long a nose as possible.
Excellent.
But if I'm going to have a very long nose, I want to be able to do what a curlew can do. That when he puts its nose or its beak into the ground, then when it's at the bottom of the hole, the tip of the bill can open so they can grasp things, and that's called rhinokinesis. That's what they've got, actually, a tweezers at the end of the nose. So if I can have some tweezers at the end of the nose to pick up things as well, then I'll have that as well, please.
Absolutely. Excellent answer. And yeah, you can have a tweezer nose and then eat anything you want. That's brilliant. Right, enough of this tomfoolery. Let's get back to the matter in hand and we'll talk about your fourth choice.
Bird number four.
I've picked two non-waders, and the first of those is the pink-footed goose, because it's always been in my birding life, really. The first time I went on a twitch, the first time I left Birmingham to go somewhere else to see waders, was to go up to the Lancashire to see the big swirling flocks of pink-footed geese. I'll digress for a second, if I may. So the school bird watching club was really important to me. I was not a particularly happy kid, and it gave me an escape route. And in fact, it was the same escape route that had been created by the creator of the bird club, who was Bill Oddie, some years before. So I was literally following the steps of Bill Oddie, which was felt quite grand, really, at a time when we were watching on the television doing the goodies. Anyway, so the first trip that I went on was to see pink-footed geese up in Lancashire. And then they've really followed me around. So I spent some years living in Edinburgh, where the pink-footed geese flocks could fly over my house. I moved to Sheffield, where in the autumn and spring, you'd see the flocks going from the west to the east coast as they moved south and then north. As the winter progressed, I then moved to Norfolk, and obviously this is pink-footed goose central. And in fact, come April, I shall be moving up to Fife, and we've already been to the house, and pink-footed goose is already on the list there. So the ankh-ankh of pink-footed geese has—they're just still was just one of those sounds. And of course, we see them in Iceland as well, but they're not special in Iceland. They're just special here. Just. You can hear them so far off, and it's just a magical sound. So the pink-footed goose, Jenny did her PhD on pink-footed geese way back in the dim and distant. So I spent a lot of time looking at pink-footed geese on the Norfolk coast as well. So yeah, it's a great species, and such different migrants as well, because here you've of course got the youngsters migrate with the parents. So you're talking about family groups. And those family groups, if you've got youngsters with you and you're a big family group, then you can bully other groups of pink-footed geese within the flocks. So therefore, having a family around you means you can defend resources. So yeah, they're just such a different lifestyle. It's not like the waders, where come the end of the summer, you will never see your kids again.
Yeah, amazing. And it's another bird that people get very affectionate about because they come in the winter time and the calls, particularly in the large flocks overhead, those streamer-like lines in the sky as they move around. And I believe it's a very high percentage of the UK wintering population in Norfolk.
Yes, and that's expanding, so that includes Suffolk and even into Essex as well. And so, yes, there are large numbers down here for a part of the winter, and one of the reasons for that has been sugar beet, particularly when a large amount of sugar beet was grown in the Norfolk fields. The tops of the sugar beet became a really good source of food. So the farmers would go on for. Contractors these days would go on and take the sugar beet crop and slice up off the tops. So the tops were sitting there waiting for the geese to eat. And this has been, well, was really good news for Pinkford geese.
Fantastic. And that's covered quite a lot in my friend Nick Acheson's book, The Meaning of Geese. Given that little plug here, if anybody hasn't read that, it came out last year. It's a lovely read.
So one of the interesting things about Pinkford geese is that they have favourite fields. And if you are looking, if I go to Norfolk with my wife, who's not studied these birds for 25 years, she will know exactly which field to look for the flock of Pinkford geese because it'll be a field which is big. It'll be away from a road. There'll be a dip in the middle of it where they can hide, and it'll be the same field that they were in, as I say, 20 odd years ago. Interestingly, when she started her PhD, she actually used the records of Peter Scott, who had studied the Pinkford geese in the same area a long time ago. And the birds were still in the same fields as they had been at that stage. And because birds travel as families, and also because they live well over 20 years, you've got this history that they know where to look for the right fields, and their youngsters will be taught to look for the right fields. And therefore, you get this history of birds using exactly the same spot year after year.
Amazing. Right, let's move on and talk about your fifth and final choice.
Bird number five.
So, bird number five is the passerine. It's a passerine which I associate with winter, but it isn't a winter migrant, and it's the missel thrush. I just think they've got such attitude. We've got a round tree in our garden. It was the first thing we planted when we moved here 20 odd years ago. And in a good year, when there's plenty of berries, a missel thrush will defend that tree. And it will wait on top of the roof until a blackbird has the temerity to go and land on the round tree and then dive bomb the hell out of it and make sure it goes away. Has a little bit more trouble when a flock of redwings come in, but it can keep that resource. And I just think that they have just such chutzpah. They just, no truck taken. Those are my berries. So this year we've not had a round crop because of the last couple of years have been pretty poor in terms of weather. But they were defending the ivy berries instead, and it's such a wonderful song. And they'll deliver it in the windiest of days. So I used to do the common bird census, which was the precursor to breeding bird survey. So I started doing common bird census when I was at school. And you could just hear a missel thrush singing from so far away, and it just carries. It's a wonderful bird.
Absolutely. And they sing early as well. You know, they perch high, they sing early, almost in the middle of winter, don't they? Or certainly towards the end of the winter, they'll start.
Yep, a bright day in February, and you'll hear the missel thrushes singing. It's another species that we've lost a lot of, but where you've got your missel thrush, you certainly know about it. And we know, you know, we did as I say, we did a bird track walk this morning, and we know where we are going to hear the three missel thrushes. And they won't sing for much longer because they're a very early nester as well. But for the moment, we know exactly where those three males are going to be strutting their stuff.
They're a lovely bird. Obviously, we're much more familiar, I think, with the song thrush, which a lot of people might think of as more affectionately because they come to gardens and they have a beautiful song. It's a bit more of a melancholy song, isn't it? The sort of missel thrush slightly, and it's a bit more ethereal because it's up there, although it carries. But yeah, they're wonderful birds.
Yeah. So yes, they do come down into gardens, and if they do hop across the lawn, they do so with they're so much more upright and more proud of themselves, chest pushed out, and as they fly off, you just got that little white tip to the tails, which is just a nice little flash as they go away.
And I love the fact that they've got so many names. You know, Stormcock is the one that people will be most familiar, which is presumably because of, like you say, the fact that they sing in the winter time and windy days, no matter whatever the weather. presumably. Jeremy Joy was a name I read in Mark Cocker's Bird Britannica, because I think it's come from January. They start at the end of January with the singing. And Big Mavis in Scotland, apparently, which was Samuel West mentioned that in Into the Red in his entry on that, because it's another bird on the red list, sadly. Talking to Samuel West, and my favourite quote of his in that piece that he wrote for Into the Red was describing the colour of the back of a missel thrush. He said it's got a back of a colour that Farrow and Ball would call mouse waistcoat and charge you a lot for.
Yes, the new house we're moving into has got Farrow and Ball paint, and I think we might have to change that because they're expensive, but they are some lovely colours. And yes, I can see that. That's a really nice description. It is. Some people say it's a cold grey, but that's not right. It is a mouse grey. It hasn't got the warmth of the song thrush, but I don't want to call it cold because they're not cold birds. They're just aloof.
And a great final choice. So those were your five birds, Graham. But you have to choose one of these. I suspect I know which one it'll be, but I'm going to ask you anyway. One of these birds has to be your spirit guide, your demon on your shoulder to accompany you on your journey through the environmental wasteland that's left after this Armageddon that's coming our way. So which of the five species will it be?
It has to be the black-tailed godwit. It's been part of our lives now for... We first went to Iceland in 2000, and we follow them wherever they go. They're our friends because of the plastic rings. They're our individual friends. And I think I probably would... There are individual birds I might take with me to this desert island that we know very well. So, yeah, it has to be the black-tailed godwit. If we had cameras on, listeners would see that there is a Bryn Edwards black-tailed godwit picture just behind me.
Brilliant. A great choice, and it's a lovely painting as well. I love Bryn's work. Right. Well, just before we go, what have you got planned this year?
So we should be moving up to Fife, getting to know some birds that we've lost from down here. So we've been in Norfolk, in this patch of Norfolk, for 20 years, and we were just talking the other day about the species that we've lost from our list in those 20 years, hardly a yellowhammer, other species that have disappeared over that time. And we're looking forward to catching up with yellowhammers and hearing skylarks all the time. And I just hope in 20 years' time we're not lamenting their loss from Fife as well. But let's hope not. So moving to Fife, and for this year, the black-tailed godwits in Iceland will have to do without us. We shan't be there this spring, but we shall be back.
Fantastic. And more wader tails, hopefully.
Yes, there's a bit of a gap. It's been a bit of a strange old year, but yes, I hope to get back to it. There's already well over 100 of the Wader Tales blogs, and the information doesn't go out of date, so it keeps getting recycled by people, which is really lovely.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's great. So if Wader Tales is new to you folks, go and check it out. I can't recommend it highly enough. Graham, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real treat to talk to you today.
My pleasure. And if you're looking for Wader Tales, it's T-A-L-E-S, a play on words, Wader Tales.
Thanks, Graham.